It's BP Deepwater Horizon Disaster Silver Lining. And I know it's difficult for people to believe that there's a silver lining. There very well be, and we're that happens. While the oil spill did cause untold physical damage, money that's been collected and will address this damage, quite a few different projects along the Gulf Coast, and also will be supporting science and social science research. I have no idea who that is or why they're... Can you excuse me for just a second, because I think it's somebody from the conference. Sir. Hello?
What do you need, Dale?
Hey, Jeff, I'm in the middle of a session at the conference. I'm giving a session right now. I'm speaking, so I can't talk to you right now. Okay, bye. Corps of Engineers in New Orleans talking about closing a sector gate, and they wanted me to get it to the paper. Apologize for that. the result of a variety of different things that have been going on in terms of money. BP's put up $1 billion as an advance payment towards their natural resource damage assessment projects that they're going to have to do. BP, Transocean, and Halliburton have entered guilty pleas for a variety of different violations that has resulted in significant money and coming into play, and there's still civil fines that are sitting out there as part of a federal trial that is ongoing in its second phase right now, and may actually have a third phase after this that could take it well into next year before we find out. And we're talking billions and billions of dollars. Our three panelists today are were supposed to be Justin Ehrenworth, who is the executive director of the Gulf Coast Ecosystem Restoration Council, which is the agency that oversees the Restore Act. And the Restore Act basically is a funnel for 80% of the Clean Water Act fines that will be used for environmental and economic damage restoration projects in the Gulf and along the Gulf Shore. Unfortunately, he's a federal employee and was not allowed to travel and is still in Miami. But I will be sort of giving a little bit of his presentation. To my far right is Maggie Walzer, who's a senior program officer at the National Academy of Sciences for their Gulf program. And Maggie is going to talk about how the National Academy of Sciences is getting a significant chunk of money and what they plan to do with their dollars. And then to my right is Mike Sharp, who is with the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. And they also have gotten a significant chunk of money from the criminal fines. And he is going to talk about what's going on with that. And so let me start out and talk a little bit about what Justin was supposed to have talked about, and just give you a brief understanding of what the Restore Act is. Under the Restore Act rules, 80% of the Deepwater Horizon Clean Water Act fines are set aside for restoration, and they're going to be split in a variety of different ways. Louisiana, Texas, Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida will directly receive an equal share of 35% of the money. Another 30% will be allocated to restoration projects that are selected by the Gulf Restoration Council under a comprehensive plan. The council has adopted an initial comprehensive plan that basically explains how they're going to put together their plan of projects. They're going to be using a formula based on the amount of oiling that using a formula based on the amount of oiling that each one of the states experienced, the five Gulf Coast states will split another 30%, which will be used for projects listed in individual state expenditure plans approved by the council. Another 5% will be dedicated to science, with 2.5% going to a Gulf Coast Ecosystem Restoration Science Program, and another 2.5% funding research grant programs at what are called Centers for Excellence in the Gulf States. That trust fund, the Restore Act Trust Fund, already has been promised $800 million over the next 2 years through the criminal fines, which are its share of Clean Water Act fines levied against Transocean, the owner and operator of the Deepwater Horizon drilling rig that exploded and sank during the Macondo well blowout in 2010. The trust fund already has in the bank $320 million of that money and will be moving over the next year to approve the first projects. Like I said, the civil trial in U.S. District Court in New Orleans will determine the remaining Clean Water Act fines. The range of dollars that would come out of that are anywhere from $2.45 billion, which is the maximum minimum amount of the fines that and I'm getting this wrong, aren't I? It's somewhere between $2.45 billion and $18 billion, and that depends on whether or not the judge rules that BP was negligence was more than just plain negligence, but rose to a higher level. But the judge is not likely to do either the $2.45 million if he finds it's just plain negligence or the worst negligence of $18 million. He's going to adjust it down. He is required by the law to look at the things that the company did to reduce the damage and also the effects of the fine on the business that the company does. That's required under the law. So we won't get all that money, but it'll still be a significant amount. And then there's also the natural resource damage assessment process that will also result in additional money beyond that amount that will go towards things. The companies involved are BP mostly, but Transocean and Halliburton also could have some of the fines levied against them, depending on what the court rules. At the moment, though, the White House Office of Management and Budget recently announced that even before the shutdown of the government, the federal shutdown because of loss of funds, that they were going to apply automatic budget reductions known as sequestration to the trust fund, which would result in withholding about $16 million this year or 5% and another $23 million or 7.3% in the 2014 fiscal year that just began. If additional fine money is deposited in the trust, it also would be subject to sequestration, but that money would eventually be released when sequestration ends. So that's a brief version of what's going on with that program. And I do have some handouts that explain a little bit more. Well, they explain a little bit about the percentages that are in this, and we'll have those over there for you guys. So with that as the beginning, can I ask Maggie, would you like to go first?
Do we need to use the microphones for the recording?
Okay. Yeah. And
okay. Good morning, everybody, and thanks for putting this panel together, Mark. So I'm with the National Academy of Sciences. So I think first it might be useful to tell you a little bit about who we are, because I find when you leave Washington, people often don't know who we are, and sometimes in Washington, people don't know who we are. I got many questions this week about whether I was furloughed, which leads me to my first point: we are not government. So the National Academies of Sciences were chartered in 1863. We're actually celebrating our 150th anniversary this year. And although we were chartered by Congress, again, we are not government. We are a private nonprofit. And we provide independent, unbiased scientific advice to the government. We also have the National Academy of Engineering and the Institute of Medicine, and then our operating arm is the National Research Council. And then to confuse things even more, sometimes we're known as the National Academies. So if you hear any of those names, that's us. In general, we're most well known for our consensus reports. So a government agency or Congress will come to us with a question. We form a committee of volunteer experts. They meet and gather information and write a consensus report that's peer-reviewed. But we also have other things that we do, including funding research grants, fellowships, convening workshops, and just other uses of whenever you need independent experts. So our funding, it's $500 million. It's $350 from BP and then another $150 from Transocean. And it came out of the criminal settlement agreements. And the settlement agreement asks us to establish a program that's focused on human health, environmental protection, and including issues that are related to offshore oil drilling and hydrocarbon production and transportation in the Gulf of Mexico on the U.S. Outer Continental Shelf. So it's a lot of words, but what it boils down to is we're going to work in human health, environmental protection, and oil system safety. And like all of our work, it'll be science-based, and decisions will be made based on scientific merit and integrity. So the nice thing is that it's going to be a 30-year program, so it's a unique opportunity for us to do some long-term planning. So within those three areas, the human health, the environmental protection, and the oil system safety, we have three objectives also defined by the settlement agreement. And those are research and development, education and training, and environmental monitoring. So I personally kind of think of it as a 3x3 matrix, but we'll see how it all comes together when we do some planning. And the settlement agreement also tells us that nothing about those three areas, the human, environmental health, and oil system safety, implies any priority, and that it's up to us to determine the balance between those in order to determine the program's objectives. Because we're very good at putting together committees, it's what we do, we put together an advisory group of 25 people. It's chaired by Barbara Schall, who recently finished a term as the vice president of the National Academies of Sciences. And so we have a mix of scientists from different disciplines. We have a mix of people who are from the Gulf and from outside the Gulf. We have one scientist who's based in Mexico to get the international perspective on the Gulf. I don't think the handouts list the advisory group members, but it does have our website, and on the website you can find the list of members. So that advisory group has been charged with they're 4 or 5 months into a one-year term, and they've been charged with guiding the planning of a new science program that's focused in those three main areas and identifying broad opportunities in those three areas. And so right over the summer, we held a couple meetings. We held a meeting in July in New Orleans and then in D.C. in August. And so that was kind of the getting everyone up to speed because some had less experience with issues, oil and gas or Gulf issues. And now in the fall, we're continuing kind of our listening and learning mode, figuring out what other activities are already happening in the Gulf. There is a lot of money. So we're trying to kind of make sense of all the different moving parts of research and work in the Gulf. So we're doing that by doing a series of state visits. So the past 2 weeks, we did a visit. We visited Alabama and Louisiana. Later this month, we'll go to Florida, and then in November we're going to visit Mississippi and Texas. And so those visits kind of have two purposes. So first, the settlement agreement actually directs us to have at least annual contact with heads of relevant natural resource or environmental departments within each state. It's different by state. So it gives us a chance to start building those relationships and also meet with some researchers and academics in the region and find out what they're up to. So One point I'd like to make is although our funds are $500 million, we actually won't have that full amount until 5 years from now. So right now we have $7 million in hand. Seems silly to say only. And then we have authorization to spend about $2 million of that. So I say that because people think, you know, why aren't you doing something already? But we don't have that full $500 million yet. And we also want to be careful. We want to think strategically and make sure that in 30 years we haven't just piddled it away and we have nothing to show for a program. Sorry, cover this. So right now the advisory group, like I said, they're learning about what's already happening in the Gulf. They're doing our state visits. But they're also trying to narrow down what will be kind of the guiding principles of the program. And we know for sure that it will be science-based, forward-looking. We have the 30 years to use the money, so it gives us the unique opportunity to have a long-term perspective. And we're being really careful to engage Gulf region stakeholders. So some of our biggest challenges, like I said, there are a lot of groups doing lots of good work. So one of our big challenges will be fitting into that existing landscape and not duplicating good work that's already being done. So we're trying to figure out kind of where our strengths of the National Academy of Sciences fit into the current needs. So what could be where we could do the most good. So like I said, the advisory group will be drafting a strategic plan, and that we hope that will be done next summer, so at the end of their one-year term. We're currently looking at ways that we might get some public input, so perhaps releasing a draft strategic plan maybe late spring of 2014, and then developing some mechanism to get public input that we can then incorporate into the final plan. And then next summer, that advisory group, their terms will expire, and then we'll have a new board. So it'll be a standard National Academies board, and their terms are usually 3 years long, and that'll serve as an advisory board for the program going forward, and we'll have some sort of rotation. And also, it's probably every 4 to 5 years, we'll be reviewing the program and maybe doing mid-course corrections to make sure we're doing the most good. And, of course, because over the 30 years, our state of scientific knowledge will change dramatically. So we'll be able to correct for that going forward. So I think that's about it for our program. And we have time for Q&A, I think, later. So.
Right. Okay. Great. Good morning, everyone. Thanks, Mark, for just want to echo Maggie's thoughts about convening this. Appreciate everybody being here, obviously, and appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. It's nice to be here. I've never been to Chattanooga before. It's a beautiful little city, so it's fun. So I'm here on behalf of the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. I'm the director of the Gulf Environmental Benefit Fund. I'm one of two co-directors, I guess. My responsibilities are for managing our programs in Alabama, Mississippi, and Florida. Tanner Johnson is my counterpart. Tanner's a former staffer, LD for Mary Landrieu. He's based in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and Texas. Just a little background on the foundation. Like NAS, we're not quite as old, but we're also congressionally chartered in 1984. We have a 30-member board that's appointed by the Secretary of Interior, and we do receive annual federal appropriations, again, not nearly in the scope that NAS does. But we use that money to leverage all sorts of on-the-ground environmental restoration projects across the country and internationally. We typically leverage on a 3-to-1 basis. So any dollars we take in for federal money, we want to try to maximize that benefit and leverage that with corporate money, with philanthropic money. And probably the largest growing part of our business are these sort of court-directed settlements, these environmental payments. And this obviously is the largest one that's ever been handed down by a court. And we handle sort of the soup to nuts. It's everything from the administrative and legal aspects of the fund to program management, project selection, and implementation, and oversight and management across the board. So. So we have been, as an organization, doing work in the Gulf for a long time. Our CEO, Jeff Trandall, likes to refer to us as the largest environmental organization that no one's ever heard of. And we don't, that's partly intentional. Our focus is really funding projects and not sort of, getting headlines. So we focus really on putting money on the ground. We've spent about $128 million in the Gulf over the course of our history. After the oil spill, BP and other entities were collecting oil that was actually saleable oil, and they used that oil to sell, created a fund for that. They called it the Recovered Oil Fund for Wildlife and gave it to us, and we spent about $128 million after the spill. We did, you know, everything from habitats to migratory birds to sea turtles to, improving, wildlife rescue facilities and those kinds of things. So, as Mark mentioned, we're kind of one of three of the larger buckets of related money for Gulf Coast restoration. Mark talked about the Restore Act. Those are the civil fines under the Clean Water Act. Still uncertain as to sort of what that funding timeline is going to look like. That court case is still pending, and we don't really have a sense of the scope of what that settlement's going to be. We certainly know what the money is prescribed for, and I think if Justin were here, I think he probably would have gone into some detail about the comprehensive plan that's just been released. It's sort of a framework for how you consider environmental restoration under the Restore Act, but it also sets the stage for how the states will come up with their conservation plans that have to kind of fit underneath that. The second significant bucket is the natural resources damage assessment. That's an ongoing process. We sort of think of NRD as the eye for an eye mitigation. So where there is a damage, there is a remedy. And in many ways, the Gulf Environmental Benefit Fund under NIFWF's management marries pretty nicely with what NRD is doing. The issue, so there's been $1 billion in NRD early assessment. Some of that money has gotten on the ground. The rest of it, about $600 million, is tied up in a two-year environmental impact assessment. So we're not sure when that money will be released. It'll probably be a couple of years from now. One of the things that's interesting about NRD is that it is a legal proceeding. So it's very it's a little bit, like the Wizard of Oz. We don't really know what's going on behind the curtain. Similarly, with Restore, we can sort of just guess what we think is going to come later. So we are kind of the third wheel here, but we are not a participant in either the NRD process nor the Restore Council process officially. What is interesting, and I'll go through who our state resource agency partners are, but each of the leads of those resource agencies is the trustee for the NRD Council and is a representative on the Restore Council. So we are very much relying on our state and federal partners to help inform our decision making about what they think is going to come later with NRD, and the issue there for us is we really want to try to maximize our investment. So we want to make sure that what we're doing potentially leverages future investment from NRD or Restore, also that it sort of matches up. And there's no we can certainly fund a portion of a project that then could be picked up by NRD or Restore dollars later, but we've got to make sure that there's, some certainty that things are going to get funded later on. So that's kind of how we fit into that, and NAS obviously is our other partner there, very much in lockstep, and we've had good conversations with them about the science role and how they envision that sort of fitting into the whole restoration process in the Gulf. So the criminal settlement directs that NIFWF is going to receive $2.54 billion over 5 years. We get we get the majority of that from BP. It's paid out over 5 years. The Transocean funding is a smaller amount. It's paid out over 2 years. We have a little bit of a hockey stick kind of profile. We get smaller amounts years 1, 2, and 3, and then more than half the money comes in years 4 and 5, which is good because it allows us to do some planning on the front end so that we make better investments with the larger pots of money as we get them in years 4 and 5. Half of the money, and I hate to use, I've used this word before, but half of the money is sequestered for Louisiana. So Louisiana receives $1.27 billion. The plea agreement is very prescribed for how we spend that money in Louisiana. We can only spend it for barrier island creation and river diversion work that's consistent with the state's coastal master plan. So we cannot do... we cannot do species work. We can't do habitat work. We can in the sense that we're creating barrier islands, and that's going to create habitat for species, but we cannot specifically do that kind of work like we will in the other four states. Very much in the state of Louisiana, we are a partner with CPRA and really function as a fiduciary to facilitate the implementation of the plan really as they envision it. The states of Alabama, Florida, Mississippi each receive $356 million. Texas receives $203 million, about 16% of the funds. The language of the plea directs us to fund projects. We are required to fund projects that remedy harm to natural resources, the type of which were affected by the spill. When we say natural resources, when we think natural resources, we think habitats and species specifically. So our job in executing these funds is to fund projects that remedy harm to habitats and species that were adversely affected by the spill. Projects can occur within any of the five states and the waters of the Gulf states. We include the waters all the way out to the EEZ, so we go all the way out to blue water. We want the projects to occur in reasonable proximity to the spill where that's appropriate. Unlike NRD, where it's really the eye for an eye, you know, there was an injury here, we fund a project to remedy that injury here. We don't have to do that. We can fund a project anywhere in the state as long as it is addressing an impact to a species that occurred in that state. So, for example, if we were going to do sea turtle nesting work, we can do that in the panhandle, but the benefit to the sea turtles isn't as great in the panhandle because the numbers of nesting sea turtles just aren't that high in the panhandle. The panhandle is where the spill occurred, but if we were going to make a turtle investment, that's not the best use of the funds to maximize the benefit for the resource. We would want to probably make that investment on the Atlantic coast where the number of nesting turtles is much, much higher. But politically, you know, we understand that there is a bullseye for what we're trying to do, and it's the Central Gulf. And probably in Florida, it doesn't extend much eastward of Apalachicola Bay, but it includes, obviously, all the coasts of Alabama and Mississippi. Louisiana, the projects are very prescribed in the master plan. And Texas, we're sort of focusing on the North Texas coast right now. We may get further later on, but we are required in selecting projects to consult with state resource agencies and our two federal partners, NOAA and Fish and Wildlife. We're also informally consulting with the Corps of Engineers, the USDA, Forest Service, NRCS, EPA, just to make sure that, you know, they're, and particularly with the Corps, we want to make sure that, you know, these are projects. Many of them will be construction projects, and they're going to require permits, and they're going to require, environmental permitting. So we want to make sure that the Corps is prepared for what we know is coming in terms of, you know, projects. So our board has the ultimate authority to select and approve projects, not to select, but to approve. We've created a subcommittee on our board. We've added some new board members from the Gulf who, you know, are very engaged and active down there, understand the resource issues, and also understand the politics, which is also important. In our conversations with the Department of Justice after the settlement was announced, we, you know, sort of had an opportunity to have a conversation with them about really what these words meant in their mind and you know, how they anticipated that we were going to implement them. And it was very clear that two things occurred. One, they want us to get money on the ground quickly. A lot of these communities, we're now 3 years out from the spill, and they have not seen a lot of, they haven't seen any restoration dollars, quite frankly, and there's a lot of frustration down there. So, fund projects quickly, get money on the ground, and start doing some good work. The second, very clearly, was that they wanted the state resource agencies to have a primary role, in selecting projects, and recommending projects to us for consideration. Each of the states has taken that on. They've created, web portals where, you know, NGOs, citizens, local elected officials can recommend projects for consideration, or comment on projects that are under consideration. And from that pool, they will be selecting projects to recommend for our consideration. Once we get them, you know, we have several filters that we have to go through to make sure that they're acceptable. Are they compliant with the plea? Are they the best use of the funds? Do they, you know, have, do they maximize the benefit to the resource? How do they fit within the context of NRD and Restore? And, you know, is it a smart investment in that context? And also, are they, you know, are they scientifically based, and do they have measurable outcomes, and all the, you know, all the things we want to see. So we very much have a relationship right now with the states and with our federal partners, but the states really have the lead. We are in a very active dialogue with them about what they really want to happen in their states, and we're sort of laying out the roadmap for what that's going to look like over the period of time. As I said, we get the money over a 5-year period. We will not obligate all the money in 5 years. It will take us longer to do that. So some of this is long-term planning. You know, as Maggie mentioned, we want to make sure that, you know, that we're looking for opportunities to leverage what we know is going to come behind us, but also, you know, leveraging other opportunities as they come, you know, through partnerships with NRCS or some of our corporate or philanthropic partners as well. The formal consultation with the states and with our two federal resource agency partners is very, it's very collaborative, it's very open. We share information, and they have all been very open to that process, and I think that will continue. So in the state, I'll just run through the consulting agencies just so you have those. In the state of Alabama, the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources has the lead. Gunnar Guy is the commissioner. In Florida, it's the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, along with DEP, who's one of their sister agencies. Nick Wiley is the head of FWC. He's our prime contact there. Louisiana, obviously, CPRA, and Garrett Graves. Mississippi, Trudy Fisher is the head of DEQ. DEQ has the lead. And Texas has this sort of multi-headed hydro, which is a little odd. But the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department has the lead. They've signed an MOU with about four other Texas agencies, and they're all working together, and somehow that works for them, and that's fine. And again, NOAA and Fish and Wildlife are our two primary federal leads. To the best of our ability, we want to facilitate consensus on projects. We want to get everybody to agree that this is the right project and the right way to proceed. We received the first monies earlier this year in January. We will be announcing an intent to obligate a portion of that first year money sometime this fall. So we've moved very quickly from plea agreement to setting up our governance structure, to developing the relationships with the states, to identifying projects. Now we will be contracting projects before the end of the calendar year. And we can execute projects and manage projects through a variety of vehicles. We don't the state doesn't have to be the lead. We can, if it is more appropriate and more efficient and a better use of the money to contract directly with an NGO to implement a project, we're fine doing that as long as the state's comfortable. So if we're doing a bird project in Florida and Audubon, you know, presents the proposal to the state doesn't necessarily have to be the awardee. We can award that contract directly to Audubon or to another NGO. And really, we're just looking to do whatever is, you know, most efficient and the best use of the funds. So I've kind of run through most of this, but there are requirements that we have that are specifically required under the plea, and then there are kind of the other considerations. And I've kind of gone through those. But again, you know, we want to align everything as much as we can with RESTORE and NRD. We want everything to be science-based and have measurable outcomes, cost-effective and leveraged where we can. And, you know, we don't want to walk down a path if we don't think that there's a chance that they can receive a permit for a specific project. So we want, within reason, we want the projects to be, you know, sort of permittable. Permittable. Is that right? So most of this information is on our website, and I have my cards, and I'm happy to talk more and answer any questions anybody has. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you. Let me go back to the Restoration Council for a second and just give you some stuff that I failed to do earlier. The Restoration Council has 11 members. Five members are the five governors of the Gulf Coast states, and the other six are all federal. It's the secretaries of the Department of Interior, Commerce, Agriculture, Homeland Security, as well as the Secretary of the Army and the administrator of the EPA. And as you can imagine, as you've already heard, in most cases, it's going to be the lower level agencies within those departments that end up representing them on the council. At the moment, the president of that council is the Department of Commerce secretary, which is rather interesting in that that's it's not the NOAA official who's doing it, but I would expect that eventually it will end up being the NOAA official. And again, the states largely end up getting represented by the people who are acting as the official trustees. And a trusteeship process here is part of the natural resource damage assessment process. The local state trustee acts as the trustee of the public trust for that state and is representing that public trust in the negotiations. In terms of the Oil Pollution Act, I think you also heard some discussion about some of the concerns for NERDA and how that process works out in because it's a court process basically, or can become a court process if there's not an agreement. The Oil Pollution Act requires that the response to the spill be governed by the federal and the responsible party interests together. And as part of the NERDA process, they both work together to determine what the damages are and then to determine how to mediate those damages or compensate for those damages. If one side walks away from that process at any time, the other side then has in court the assumption that their information is correct, and the side that walked away has to prove that they're wrong in court. And that's what results in the natural resource damage assessment process being this secretive sort of a thing. Neither side wants information to be released in advance of making those, you know, going through that decision-making process so that they aren't laying their cards out on the table in case they go to court, which is problematical for the public. But we'll see how it works. This obviously is the largest sort of a case where that's occurred. And that flows into everything else, both what both of these guys are doing and what the Restore Act are doing. Largely, they have to worry about, well, if we do this project, is that something that NERDA actually would be required to do? Is this something that they're doing? Do we want to spend this money here when NERDA money already will be allocated to that? So that's a significant problem. The states are dealing with that as well. The other thing is you also heard, for instance, in Louisiana, and I know the most about Louisiana, obviously. Louisiana has had a master plan for coastal restoration and storm surge protection since 2007. In 2012, it was upgraded and made into a 50-year, $50 billion plan for restoration and protection, with $25 billion going to restoration and $25 billion going to protection. That plan put them well ahead of the other states because Restore Act requires the other states, all the states, to have a plan to begin with. And it also has other requirements about individual parishes or counties also have to have basically a land use plan as well. So those sorts of things will also be kicking in, and it's rather interesting. But there are some confounders in there. Some of this money will be able to be used for infrastructure, but there's a limit on that, 25% in any area, and Louisiana has also already made it clear that they're probably going to be even more limiting than that, although once you get to the point where a new governor comes in, that may go away. So we'll see. But the state of Louisiana also has several constitutional amendments that have pretty much limited how you use money that is in the state's conservation budget and how the master plan is required to be addressed. Any state action must comply with the master plan, no matter what it is. So those are some other things that are going on. So I'm going to throw it open to questions now, and I guess let me start out with one of the first, and that is let's talk about the elephant fish in the room, and that is who's representing the deep water Gulf of Mexico, and how do you guys deal with that within your structures, or do you deal with it within your structures for the money that you're dealing with? And I'll start with you.
Jimmy, what do you mean by deep
water? I'm talking about stuff not in state waters, but in federal waters and out. So research, you know, for you, it would be what kind of research are you planning? Is there going to be research money available to deal with those kinds of issues?
So we don't know yet what kinds of projects we'll be funding. It'll probably be a year before we can issue any sort of call for proposals, but we are not limited to state waters.
Okay.
I don't know if that answers your question sufficiently, but I don't want to make any promises, but I will tell you we're not limited to state waters.
So, again, the plea agreement says that we are to fund projects in each of the states and their waters, and we extend those all the way out to the EEZ. The issue for us, and again, it's a coordination issue, and Mark just kind of hit on it, is what is the NRD process in blue water? And what is that assessment? And what can we do that isn't going to get in their way? The plea requires that we fund projects. Sometimes to make an informed project decision, we have to do some research on the front end. Okay, we can't use this money for good science. We have to use it to fund projects. Okay, so I do envision us doing some fisheries-related science, stock assessment, that type of work, where it's leading to changes in management, and we would consider those management changes projects. So those are in our mind acceptable uses, and I think DOJ and the court would agree with us. The tricky part for us is NOAA's focus, obviously, is in that blue water under their NERDA hat, and you know we've got to be cognizant of that and allow that process to move forward without being a stick in the mud in that process. So it's a little bit of a balance, but I certainly can see us doing some fisheries related research on the front end that will help inform management changes later.
Okay. And Maggie, one other question for you, and that has to do with soon after the oil spill, my editors came to me and said, "Hey, we want you to write a story about this umbrella of research that's being done in the Gulf of Mexico about the spill. Who's in charge of all this research and how's it being done?" And I had to explain to them that there's no one in charge and everybody's just running off and doing their own thing. So one of the questions I have for you is, as part of the process, are you guys looking at attempting to figure out a way of creating that kind of an umbrella?
In our meetings that we've had so far, I think everyone would, because we are good at convening, I think lots of people would like us to serve in that role. But we're still trying to decide if that's the best way to use the funds. So there are a lot of different groups, especially right after the spill. You had the NSF Rapid Grants. You have GOMRI, the Gulf of Mexico Research Initiative. I always want to say institute. initiative. So they
Which
also
was $500 million
over 10 years. Yeah, yes. So straight from that was the money that BP out of the goodness of their hearts gave right after the spill. Right now there's a lot of ad hoc coordination going on behind the scenes. So all of the groups who are working in the Gulf of Mexico, it's kind of just this monthly conference call, and they update each other on what's going on. And so for now, that's kind of working, and I will. And you're not the only one who has asked if we will serve as conveners, but that's something that will be decided within the next year.
And at the moment, GOMRI's been trying to do it. The Gulf of Mexico Research Initiative has actually been trying to do that. They've had two conferences.
Yes,
where
so they've
tried
to so they've been holding.
Sort of
there'll
update
be a
on where research
and
is,
they'll be holding their next conference in Mobile in January.
Okay.
And there's also some sensitivity. So in many respects, we're the new kid on the block in terms of doing work in the Gulf of Mexico, and we don't want to come in and say, you know, we're going to be in charge of all of this and offend everyone. So we have to be careful.
So let me open it up to you guys. Start.
Where did the oil go? Is anybody really researching that and what its long-term effects are? I mean, if you look at Exxon Valdez, 20 years later they've come out with, we don't know. It may be under rocks, but we don't know.
I hope that won't be the case 20 years from now, but I do know that a lot of the work that's being funded by GOMRI is tracking some of the oil and looking at. It's the Gulf of Mexico Research Initiative, and that was the $500 million that BP gave to the states right after the spill, out of the goodness of their heart. So they have 10 years to spend that money, and a lot of that work is going towards. So, yeah, I attended their conference last year, and a lot of the research being presented was tracking the oil, trying to figure out what kind of the ecosystem impacts were. So hopefully we'll be more successful this time around.
And GOMRI, is that
G-O-M-R-I?
Yeah.
And is there somebody there in charge?
Yeah,
there's a
Right.
Yeah, so it's Rita Caldwell, who was at NSF. So the granting mechanism is run a lot like NSF granting is. And then their, I think his title's chief scientist, is Chuck Wilson.
Okay.
But before we leave that, I think part of that answer is going to come out of the NRD process as well.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so that assessment is, they are assessing the damage to the resources, right? So part of that damage is, what happened? right? Where is the oil now, and what are the long-term effects of that
oil?
What's
going on in the really deep water?
Sure. What we've seen so far is that there are these, it's like little tiny slices of research that we've seen come out from a couple of months after the spill all the way forward, and a variety of those studies have shown that there was a flow of material 1,500 feet below the surface that moved southwest away from the rig, and others that moved northeast towards the Florida coast. That material probably was natural gas mostly, and probably disappeared because it was eaten by organisms that then died and went to the bottom. In some locations where that occurred, other studies showed that they fell on coral and killed the coral. A new study that came out 2 weeks ago, that became publicized 2 weeks ago, it actually came out earlier than that, showed that there was significant damage in an area about 50 miles around the well site itself, based on assessment of organisms living in the benthos, the sediment at the top. There are a variety of different studies that have shown what's been going on along the Gulf Coast. There was an effort this year by BP at the insistence of the state of Louisiana and Mississippi to do snorkeling tests along in the near shore waters along the coast, and they found large quantities of mats of material there, and have been digging it up and carting it away, millions of pounds more of material, and each time there's a storm, additional material shows up. So that's part of that question.
Yeah.
The full question, we're going to have to wait for NERDA for some additional answers. Yes, sir.
Randy Shostak with EOS of the American Geophysical Union. Just in general, how much do you feel that the agreement and the money will or could make things whole again in and along the Gulf?
Okay, so let me repeat the question for the tape. So, how much will the money help restore things along the coast?
So we actually won't be doing restoration projects. It's more likely that we'll be doing science to support restoration, so I'm going to talk about that one.
Yeah. So $2.54 billion is a lot of money, right, in anybody's, except for the federal government maybe, but that's a lot of money. In the grand scheme of things, When you look at the ecosystems and the long-term damage, not just from BP and Macondo, but historically what's happened, particularly in Louisiana, with Barrier Island deterioration, loss of habitat through development, water quality issues, So it seems like a lot of money on paper, but once you start funding distinct projects, you can spend that money pretty quickly. I think it's incumbent on us, the Restore Council, and the NRD trustees to ensure that we're making investments that maximize that benefit, right? So we are investing that money wisely so that it has long-term benefit to the environment and to the ecosystem and to the habitat and species beyond our lifetime. That's a challenge. I guess the follow-up question is, what in your mind, what is whole? What do you... Because I think we can do great restoration, and we can do excellent projects that are going to improve estuaries and tidal marshes and barrier islands and fish and birds and turtles. Can we get them to where they were 100 years ago? Probably not. But we can make, if you're in conservation, I think if you're making a 25% improvement in a species, that's a really significant improvement. And I think that would be, you know, we would want to shoot for whatever the best achievable goal on a project-by-project basis, and then looking more broadly at the ecosystem as a whole, what's the best we can achieve with these investments?
Right. Yep. Hi, I'm Bill Allen from the University of Missouri Journalism School. And, being from the Midwest, I'm still getting my head around this bill itself and the impacts, but now where's the money going to go to do research and restore? And maybe first with Maggie, and I can take my turn later with Mike. But it kind of sounds like a big NSF, where you're going to be, you'll have your strategic plan, and you'll have your process for deciding what projects to fund. Long-term research, I'm guessing. So can you kind of go farther or further from there and tell me how are you going to select projects? I know you're going to convene a lot of people, but does NAS act like this in other cases where you have a big amount of money and you get help and get it to the best science projects?
So I'll start with your last question. So I think the best example of us funding research is through our Transportation Research Board. So it's federal money that goes to all the state departments of transportation, and then they pool it together and give it back to our Transportation Research Board, and then they do granting for transportation-related science. Sometimes it's very down in the weeds, like, you know, the best material for a new highway in cold weather regions. Sometimes it's bigger picture, like designing transit systems. So that's probably our best example of funding projects. So I think part of our strategic planning this year is determining kind of what sorts of projects we'll fund. It's likely that a large chunk of the $500 million will go back out the door to fund new research. And I think it's looking like our role, so we're working in, you know, human health, environmental protection, and oil system safety. I think our role might be finding science and research that kind of bridges what could wind up being siloed research and kind of funding kind of higher level research that'll synthesize results from the different disciplines and kind of give us the bigger picture of what's going on in terms of the balance between resource development and protecting an ecosystem and protecting the health of the local population. So that's where I kind of see us fitting. But
ask each of you for an example. We're up in the Midwest. We're real good at putting nutrients into the Mississippi River that then go down and meet up the Gaylord. Again, what kind of, can you give me a good example of, say, the most important restoration effort that needs to go on down there with your funds? And I know I'm asking you this prematurely, but you must have some idea. And the same for you, what kind of science is most necessary to do that will in turn inform, you know, through these adaptive management processes, will inform their grants? Is that something like that?
Okay. So I think the question is, what's the best kind of project can you do, and what's the best kind of science that will inform that project?
Examples.
I can start with one. I did, just going back to the previous question about making the Gulf whole. I can see us playing a role in determining what whole means at this point. So, for lack of a better technical term, we've messed with that ecosystem so much, we're never going to get it back to its pristine conditions. So I could see us kind of helping to define what whole means and what works best for all stakeholders when we include, say, species and ecosystems as a stakeholder, and so that then the restoration projects would have kind of goals to strive for.
So we have in our conversations with the states and the federal resource agencies, we've come up with sort of, you know, a suite of different kinds of projects. If you look across the entire Gulf, taking out South Florida because that's really a pretty unique environment that's different than the Central Gulf. But you know, you're looking at bays and estuaries, you're looking at beach and dune habitat, you're looking at coastal marsh, you're looking at buffer forests, marsh buffers, species-wise, you know, I think we're looking at shorebirds, migratory birds, beach nesting birds, even pelagic birds potentially, fish species. I think the focus will probably be on reef fish. I think that's where the states want the focus to be. Snapper, grouper, those types of fish. They are the one of the most significant recreational and commercial fish in the Gulf. So I think a lot of focus potentially will be there. Sea turtles. You know, we can specifically. You know, what? How can we work with you know, the bird NGO community to ensure that coastal nesting bird habitat is protected and that that management has some longevity to protect that the you know, that nesting habitat over a long period of time to ensure, you know, reproduction. That's, you know, that's kind of a kind of an easy one. You know, when we start talking about coastal marsh restoration, it gets a little trickier. You know, what does that mean? And it gets to the other question about what is whole. You know, well, you know, what should that marsh? I think we would envision, you know, a marsh restoration project to maximize the functionality of that ecosystem for you know, for the species that live there, and for water quality purposes to the greater bay and estuary and Gulf wide. Maybe. So, did I get it? Okay.
Let me add a little bit to this, because in Louisiana already has numerous projects planned and wants to use this money to build those projects. And especially with the restoration projects, they are rather controversial because of past restoration projects. Louisiana had two major freshwater diversions that were built in the 80s and 90s. And they were designed to freshen the wetlands, not to add sediment to the wetlands, although they did add some sediment. But the result of that was that they were it was done at a time when the Corps of Engineers had to have a benefit-cost analysis that made the projects worthwhile, and so they aimed them at specific resources. In this case, it was oysters. So we're going to build more oysters way out here by putting more fresh water out here. Okay. Well, there are commercial oystermen in that area where all that fresh water went, and it killed all their oysters, or they say it killed all their oysters. They won a $2 billion lawsuit against the state in state court over that devastation, and then the state Supreme Court came in and threw it out, saying, no, our Constitution has a requirement that the environment must be balanced with economic aspects, and in this case, the environment of the state of Louisiana wins. You guys have to sit back and recognize that the environment is more important for a variety of different reasons. So that, you know, very unusual for a state like Louisiana, but yes, that happened. But going forward, those same oystermen are fighting the new diversions, which will be designed to capture huge amounts of sediment during high river years, like 1993, like 2011. During that period, you open up these diversions and they build land. And what the oystermen say and what the shrimpers say and what the fishermen say, who all are basically, you know, a certain salinity requirement for their resources, are saying, we don't believe you that the way you're going to do this. You're going to keep them open and you're going to destroy our livelihoods. And from day one, the state has said, you know, we may end up destroying some people's livelihoods, but it's beneficial for the state in the long run, returning the Mississippi River to something similar to what it did originally. So those are the kinds of issues that everybody's going to have to be dealing with as these projects go forward. And the way those projects go forward is that they will have long-term environmental impact statement processes that are going on just like any other project, and lots of public meetings, and the state's already said that it intends to increase the number of public meetings that it will have as part of that process to get everybody involved.
Can I just follow up on that and then quickly back to Bill for a second? Each of our state partners has also said that they, you know, want to have an open public process. So they are, I think, under the terms of their individual state laws and what's in the best interest of the public, figuring out what that's going to look like. So we will be a participant with them as that moves forward. So that's a good point, and I forgot to mention that. But to your point on the Upper Mississippi, the nutrient and sediment issue in the Upper Miss and its relationship to the Gulf of Mexico is a significant one. Neither the Restore Act dollars, because of the proximity to the coast requirement, nor our dollars because of the requirement that we spend money within the boundaries of each state, allow us to address that issue, right? So when we talk about hypoxia, when we talk about nutrient, when we talk about sediment, none of this money can address what one of the biggest drivers of deterioration in the Gulf is, and that's Upper Miss. So I'm not sure how we get there. That's a national discussion that we need to have that's bigger than the BP oil spill, quite frankly. But it's an interesting point. It's just worth keeping in mind as we move forward.
So let me ask you. didn't y'all just get $55 million from the Halliburton settlement that's unrestricted?
Correct.
What are the plans for using that money?
Still to be determined. That's up to our leadership and the board, and I think those conversations are ongoing. I don't have any sense. Again, that's another Wizard of Oz conversation behind the curtain I'm not privy to, so I can't say.
Okay.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Louisiana pancake batfish.
I'm sorry?
The Louisiana pancake batfish.
Yeah.
Was discovered, I think, in 2008, more or less, as a species. Now, what effect, I mean, do we still know if it still exists? And what effect would oil coming down on it mixed with Corexit have on a species like that? That's for you.
Can't answer that. Yeah. Can't answer that one. Didn't even know that was a species. But I need to be honest with you. I'm not a scientist. I'm not. And you know, so. But I think the answer to that question again goes back to my earlier answer. That's the purpose of NRD, right? The purpose of NRD is to determine the impact of the oil spill and the response to the oil spill, quite frankly, on individual species. So I would assume that. I can certainly check on the batfish with our NOAA colleagues and see if they have any or can share anything. I don't know.
Pancake batfish. Exxon was an opportunist here, mm-hmm. using the spill for the gushing, deploy Corexit, which is a dispersant, and see what it did, because it had never been done before on this scale.
You're talking about for Valdez.
Excuse me?
You're talking about for Valdez?
No.
Oh, okay. So you took BP, not Exxon.
Yeah. Are you studying that or looking at it to see
the
in terms of impacts of
ethics, morality?
I'm going to stay with them.
I will respond to that based on my own reporting, and I would suggest to you that it was not used, you know, because they wanted to test how it was used. It was used because they had a heck of a lot of it in a warehouse, and it was available, and they'd already paid for it. And so they used it, and they and the environmental groups made a request of EPA
to stop its use? And EPA said, yeah, that's a really good question. And that was the end of that conversation. And the judge, you know, the judge in this civil case basically has thrown out that portion of the case. And so there, you know, I doubt the, you know, where we're going to be looking for this, for, you know, that kind of question is not going to be about, you know, it's not going to be study of the morality of using it, but rather how do we deal with whether or not it actually works. There's research going on into whether or not the deep water use of it, which was the first time it was ever used, actually worked, whether that had anything to do with the actual dispersing of the oil that actually occurred at depth. And there are a variety of different research projects underway funded by that $500 million that BP put out into green chemistry versions of dispersants to take the place of CoreXit and its other, you know, alternatives. But at the moment, you know, the as far as I know, the EPA list of chemicals that are approved for use on oil spills today still continues to have CoreXit on that list. As far as I, unless somebody can correct me from that, but I'm pretty sure that that's true. Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to note that we at Med Chem Institute is doing a program about dispersant science in Mobile as part of that conference in January. So I can't answer these questions for you right now, but we'll have people who are experts in Mobile answer these questions.
So from the audience, Metcalf Institute is doing a panel on the science of dispersants in the future. Other questions?
So I want a little more background. How did it come to pass that both of your organizations were selected to receive such significant funding? And what was your initial reaction to that?
So I can tell you that I don't know the full story. I know that the Department of Justice approached our lawyers, and the rest is history. And then there were, you know, negotiations about, you know, whether we were the right organization for the job, and I think we worked with them a little bit on the settlement language. I imagine it's because we are known for providing objective, unbiased scientific advice, and we are non-political.
It's exactly the same answer, actually. So we have a long history with the Department of Justice managing these types of funds on behalf of injured parties. We have an entire division, the Impact Directed Environmental Accounts Division within NIFWIF. This is all that they do. That said, this is significantly larger than this. You know, this is the largest criminal settlement in history, in the history of American industry. So I think our reaction was okay, but you know, we were appropriately respectful, and you know, obviously we approached this with a degree of seriousness and intended purpose here. I mean, we want to be an excellent fiduciary for these funds, and we want to make sure that the projects that we're funding are really, really good projects that have long term benefit.
Other questions?
Just one quick one. Should we consider this to be public money?
I think we don't think of it as our money. We think of ourselves as the stewards of this fund that is meant to benefit the people of the Gulf. I don't know if you interpret.
which part are we talking about? The Restore Act is definitely public money. I mean, that's federal money. It's going into the budget, and in fact, Congress carved it out from returning it to the budget, thank heavens, and is using it for a good use. The others, they're, you know, largely the result of settlements between the federal government and a private company.
administered by court, so it's public money as far as I'm concerned.
As you all know, the oil industry is right on the verge of going into deep water drilling, which is...
It's not on the verge of, it's in it.
They're doing it.
Yeah.
Well,
they're doing it.
Deeper.
Deep water, yeah, deep water. Are you zero? Okay, studying that, the ramifications, the possibilities of a similar thing as BP's, you know, having a 10, 15,000 feet of water. What can we do?
So again, we're not studying anything yet, but I will tell you that our settlement language does include looking at oil system safety. But we've also cannot spend on anything the government would already do, so any sort of research, say, a regulatory agency would fund. And we also don't want to duplicate anything the industry is already doing. But I could see us doing kind of an assessment of the best available knowledge and kind of a compendium of the state of the science in terms of what we know about deeper and deeper water drilling.
Okay. Well, we're pretty close to out of time, guys.